Chief Operating Officer in the National Department of Health.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Tiny Rennie. I'm the head of corporate services in the National Health Department.
Morning, Chair. My name is Ian van der Merwe. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Health.
Good morning, honorable members. I'm Anne Pillay. I'm the Deputy Director General for Health Regulation and Compliance, and also acting in the NHI branch.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Ndina Mpapuli. I'm Director for Infrastructure and National Health.
Morning. My name is Chilani Masilela. I'm the Chief Director for Health Information Management and Monitoring and Evaluation.
I'm Joe. Everybody knows Joe.
You know, a bat doesn't know whether it's a mouse or a... I think Joe doesn't know whether he belongs to this side or the other side, but we know Joe. So we've always been in contact with him. You know, I was reading the report. There's always been something that we've been asking ourselves as members. The National Department of Health, the minister answers questions when there are problems with health, but the actual work is done in the provinces. And we've always been asking ourselves, how do you coordinate and integrate that work? But looking at the report here, especially some of the good things that have happened, by the way, congratulations for your unqualified audit report.
Thank you.
Now the next step that we're looking for a clean report, which is going to talk about performance. But congratulations, I think you've done very well. But looking at this report, reading it, especially from the DG's report, it shows that you seem to be in contact with the provinces. And some of the achievements that you have made is because you are constantly in contact with provinces. But there are still challenges. There are still doctors that complain that they have not been paid. There are still people that are using their own linen in hospitals. But it shows that there is something, that there's an integration. I must comment that part. Okay, we give over to you, Seki.
Thank you very much. Chair, we will also respond to, and during the question and answer time, about how we are engaging with the provinces and what our specific roles are in engaging with the provinces and what our experiences have been as well. So, Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity to present the annual report on behalf of the department for 2011 and 2012. The purpose of the presentation is to reflect on key issues, both achievements and areas where there are still challenges. So we will address the areas of challenges, and hopefully we will also outline how we intend addressing those challenges as you requested. The structure of the presentation, it's a fairly long presentation, so apologies for that, but it's a fairly comprehensive presentation. It will start with the national health priorities. It will review all six program areas, budget program areas. We will talk about the budget and expenditure per program and the budget and expenditure per economic classification, and we will explain the variances that we found. We'll say a little bit about the audit outcomes and the recommendations, and we'll spend some time talking about conditional grant expenditure, because the conditional grant expenditure really forms the bulk of the total budget of the National Department of Health. And then we'll say a little bit about the trading entities and public entities, and then some concluding remarks. I think it's fairly well known that in 2009, 2010, when the new administration took over after the elections of 2009, the department and the minister in particular signed to deliver four outputs, signed a contract with the president. One is to increase life expectancy. Second is to reduce maternal and child mortality rates. Third is to combat HIV and AIDS and burden of disease from TB. And finally, to strengthen the health system's effectiveness. And these outputs, just to reinforce it, all members I'm sure know, are related to the Millennium Development Goals, which we should be achieving by 2015. And those four outputs are also directly related to the 10-point plan, which we adopted in 2009. And they all relate, Honourable Chairperson, to outcome two of the Cabinet decision to have a multiplicity of apex outcomes, which is a long and healthy life for all South Africans. So So this is, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, how all of these things stack up against each other. And all the slide shows is the alignment between the 10-point plan, the four NSDA outputs, as well as the health-related MDGs. So moving on to then a review by program area. Program one, as Honourable Members know, is administration. And as the Honourable Chair mentioned already, we've obtained an unqualified audit opinion from the Auditor General in 2011 and 2012. And this is the second unqualified opinion over a three-year period. And clearly we would like to both sustain it and to get a clean report, as the Chair suggested, going forward. Given that asset management was the basis for the qualified opinion in 2011-12, an asset management plan was developed and implemented by the Department of Health. A key challenge that we experienced, which we have been able to overcome, was the valuation of the asset register. With respect to financial management amongst the provinces, and this speaks to the way in which we engage with provinces, four of the nine provinces unfortunately overspent their budgets for 2011-12. They are the Eastern Cape, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Northern Cape. The factors that contributed to these projected over-expenditure were significant prior year accruals, which they had to pay off in 2011-12. Price increases, and I think as honourable members know, medical inflation always runs higher than general inflation. Inadequate budget controls in some instances, as well as underfunding of the health sector. And I think we can speak more about this during the question and answer period and after the CFO presents on the budget. What have we done? The provinces have financial management improvement plans, which are being, and all nine of them have them, and we have obtained technical support from National Treasury, the Technical Assistance Unit in National Treasury. So working with the Department and National Treasury, we are supporting all nine provinces to implement their provincial financial management plans. Some of the challenges that even though we have these plans, these provincial financial improvement plans, they are constrained by inadequate human resource capacity and limited funds to implement the plans. And again, between the CFO, the ADG for Corporate Services and the Chief Operating Officer, they will give a bit more of an answer on what the specific challenges are in some of the provinces. We have been helped in terms of funding from a number of international development partners, support for which we are very grateful for, but it's a small amount relative to the total budget. So it's less than 2% of the total budget, but it's an important contribution to the health system in South Africa. So moving on to Program 2, which is Health Planning and Systems Enablement. In 2010, we conducted the National Antenatal Sentinel HIV and Syphilis Prevalence Survey in partnership with key stakeholders, and this was published and launched by the Minister in November 2011. Chair, we are one of the few countries in the world that has done this survey as many times as we have. So we have a 20-year database starting in 1990 through to 2010, and obviously we've done it in 2011 as well. The data from the 2010 prevalence survey and all the other ones play a significant role in informing programmatic responses of the government, civil society, and international partners with respect to HIV and AIDS. We are in the process of collecting finalizing the report for 2011, and we hope to produce that result fairly soon. In 2011, in July, we had a National Health Research Summit, which was convened by the National Health Research Committee, which is a ministerial advisory committee which is provided for in the National Health Act. And this summit identified strengths and weaknesses and opportunities with respect to health research, with respect to the four NSDA outputs for 2010 to 2014. The summit also aimed to identify key priorities that can be used to strengthen health research, innovation, and development over the next 3 to 5 years. And we had a number of stakeholders represented in that meeting, representatives from government departments, non-governmental organizations, various industries that relate to health, the research councils, professional organizations, academia, and civil society. And this report was published in the Lancet, which is a very prestigious journal, Honorable Chair, in April of 2012. we recognize that as part of health planning and systems enablement, monitoring and evaluation is a very important component, and it's seen also in the report from the Auditor General on non-financial performance. With respect to M&E for the ART program, the antiretroviral program, we have implemented a three-tier system to monitor the implementation of the antiretroviral program. Tier one of the system consists of a paper-based register, which is based on the World Health Organization register. Paper two is an electronic register for non-networked computers, so they're not linked up to the internet or the web. And tier three, which is the most advanced, is the one that's networked, and it's actually a patient information system. So we are using the three-tier system for ARVs as a way to develop a patient-linked information system for primary healthcare. And again, we can say more about this and what progress we're making later. We've trained 133 master trainers in tiers one and two, and we have implemented tier two now in 890 sites. Clearly, this is far short of the total number of sites that are initiating ARVs, which is more than 3,000, but we think that this is a good start, and we've started with those sites, Honorable Chair, that have large numbers of patients. Honorable members would recall that the Director General set up the Health Data Advisory Coordinating Committee in October 2010, and this committee was established to get consensus on key health outcomes for the country, and it produced its first report in 2011-2012. And what it basically did is that it took the best evidence we have from the scientists, the demographers, the epidemiologists in the country to give us estimates of life expectancy, infant mortality, child mortality, and maternal mortality, together with neonatal mortality. And in my last slide, Chair, I will come back to that issue and show how we are doing relative to the targets that we had set ourselves through the HDACC. With respect to the National Health Insurance, as I think honorable members know, the minister unveiled 10 pilot sites, with the 11th pilot site chosen by KwaZulu-Natal, Amajuba. And there's a conditional grant, an NHI conditional grant, that was allocated, and where we've allocated money to each of these pilot sites that we are now supporting. So over the next MTEF, we will be supporting these 10 plus 1 pilot sites with respect to NHI development. As the honorable members know, we have a significant shortage of medical doctors in the country, and we've had a long-standing collaboration program with the Cuban government, and we've been sending fairly significant numbers of students to Cuba to study medicine. So in the 2011-12 financial year, we sent 80 students to Cuba, 12 from the Eastern Cape, 10 from Gauteng, 12 from KwaZulu-Natal, 10 from Limpopo, 12 from Mpumalanga, and 12 each from the Northwest and Northern Cape. Chair, just to say that we are currently in the process of sending the next batch of students to Cuba. And again, we can provide more information on that later. But that's something we're doing currently. Chair, notwithstanding those achievements, there are outstanding challenges and for which we have some remedial action proposed. The Auditor General conducted an audit of performance in the information and reported, and which we reported in the annual report. The AG expressed satisfaction in all material respects of the presentation and usefulness of performance information in accordance with the predetermined criteria that we agreed with the AG. The AG acknowledged that leadership was being provided to strengthen the health information system, as evidenced by the development of national policies for health information systems and the production of draft standard operating procedures. Apologies, Chair, for those acronyms. So HIS stands for Health Information System, and SOP is Standard Operating Procedures. However, the AG identified major challenges with respect to the reliability of data for 9 indicators in Program 3, which they tested in 20 public health facilities in 8 provinces. So, Chair, what the AG did this year and last year, they selected a number of sites where they went to visit the sites, public health facilities, clinics and hospitals. They took our data, and then they tried to reconcile it with data that they found in the facilities. And they found some challenges with the reliability of the data between those two. And when we come to responding to why that's so and what we're doing about it, I'll ask Mr. Masilela to explain why the variance and what we're doing about it. What we have done in response to the AG's concerns and our own concerns is that we've developed a roadmap to strengthen health information systems. This was adopted by the National Health Information Systems Committee of South Africa. The National Health Information Systems Committee is made up of representatives from the National Department, Provincial Departments of Health, and significant other role players to strengthen the health information system in the country. And it's a subcommittee of the National Health Council Technical Committee. Moving on then here to Program 3, which is HIV and AIDS, TB, oh, sorry for the spelling error there, and maternal child and women's health, we'll first report on combating HIV and AIDS. A total of 617,147 new patients were initiated on antiretroviral treatment in 2011-12, compared to 418,677 in 2011 and 2010-2011. As you can see here, this is a significant difference year on year. As part of our HCT campaign, which was launched by the President in April 2010, we continued trying to accelerate the number of people who are testing for HIV and being screened for TB. And during 2011-2012, 9.6 million South Africans accepted HIV counseling and testing. Now, Chair, before the campaign, just as a benchmark, annually we had about 2 million people testing for HIV. So this is, you know, more than four times, almost five times more than the figure we had historically. Over a 20-month period, starting in April 2010 to July last year, a cumulative total of just over 20 million people tested for HIV, and a significant number, which we don't have here, were also screened for TB. With respect to condoms, Chair, we had a target of 6 million female condoms to be distributed in 2011-12, and we overshot that mark marginally and distributed 6,353,000 female condoms. With respect to TB management, for 2010, and Chair, I need to just inform the Honourable Members that the TB cure rate is always 1 year late because we follow cohorts. So we don't have a 2011 number. We'll have the 2011 number this year. Cure rate for 2010 was 73.1% against a target of 75%. This reflects a slight improvement over the cure rate for 2009, which we reported in 2010-11, of 71.1%. The TB defaulter rate has decreased from 7% in 2010-11 to 6.8% in 2011-2012. We would like to see this defaulter rate come below 5%. With respect to improving child health, the national immunization coverage, that is fully immunized children under one, we achieved a target of 95.2% against a target of 95%. So we're marginally over the target that we had set ourselves. There's some very good news, Honorable Chair, which I'm sure Honorable Members saw from the media when the Minister launched these figures. To independently verify the impact of our prevention of mother-to-child transmission program, we asked the Medical Research Council to do an independent survey of the transmission rate. So our figures suggest that in 2008, the transmission rate from mothers to children was 8%. When the MRC did the study in 2010, the transmission rate had dropped to 3.5%. And when they did the survey again, they repeated the survey in 2011-12, the figure dropped to 2.7%. And this is at 6 weeks post-delivery. So as Honourable Members can see, we are decreasing quite rapidly the transmission of HIV from mothers to children. With respect to postnatal care, 56.9% of mothers and 57.8% of babies receive postnatal care within 6 days post-delivery against a target of 60%. So we still have a little way to go in ensuring that all mothers who deliver and their babies receive postnatal care 6 days after delivery. As Honourable Members know, antenatal coverage is a very important indicator of how we deal with people, women and pregnancy, during pregnancy. And our district health information system recorded a 100% coverage of antenatal care, which is the same as the target. One challenge we have is the denominator, which we are discussing with STAT South Africa. Because it's quite clear that our antenatal coverage, real antenatal coverage, is not 100%. 40% of pregnant women present to their health services within 20 weeks of pregnancy. And our target was also 40%. But we would like 100% of women to come in the first 20 weeks. So clearly we would need to do more, both on the supply side and on the demand side, to get pregnant women to come as early as possible for antenatal care. The good news is that we are testing all pregnant women for HIV. So 100% of pregnant women were tested for HIV. But remember, these are those that come for antenatal care. And that's why coming for antenatal care is so important, so that they can be tested for HIV. Almost 90% of deliveries took place in health facilities under the supervision of qualified health personnel. This is against a target of 90%. So we still have about 10% of deliveries happening at home or in the communities, which again is something we would like to address. With respect to cervical cancer screening, our coverage rate for 2010-11 was 55% against a target of 52%. But again, we would like to see 100% of those that are targeted for cervical cancer screening obtaining. Some of the challenges, you would note, Honorable Chair, that I didn't talk about male condoms, and I'll talk about it now. With respect to medical male circumcision, again, apologies, MMC stands for medical male circumcision. We had a target of 500,000 medical male circumcisions for 2011-12, and we conducted 347,973 medical male circumcisions, with KwaZulu-Natal conducting the most. While this is lower than the target of 500,000, this reflects, we think, Tulani, is your battery done? Challenge with male condoms. As the honourable members know, we have set a target of 1 billion male condoms distributed free because it's the mainstay of our prevention program outside of PMTCT. We were only able to purchase and distribute just under 400 million male condoms. And the problems here were the following. One was that there was a global shortage of latex, you know, which is used to make male condoms. The second was that we had a significant delay in provinces registering the bidders. In 2009-2010, we from the National Department placed the orders, purchased the condoms, and paid for them from the National Department. From 2010, we had delegated this to provinces. So we put it into the conditional grant of provinces, and provinces then were purchasing against a national tender. That required provinces to put all of the bidders, all of the successful tenderers on their system, on their LOGIS system. And provinces experienced many challenges, and many of the challenges related to vendors not being able to provide tax certificates and that kind of stuff. So we have corrected this in the new financial year, and I'll explain later what we've done in 2012-11 to correct this. With respect to the measles immunization coverage, as I think honourable members know, with the first dose of measles, we do very well because many mums bring their children at 6 weeks. It's the second dose that we struggle with, that mums don't bring their children often in. And you can see that the second dose, we achieved a target of 85% against the target of 95%. So we need to do more to ensure that the second dose is delivered. And again, I'll explain some of the initiatives we have in place currently to improve on the immunization coverage. With respect to the HIV 20, with respect to the HIV prevalence, so we back on, Chair. With respect to the HIV prevalence, Chair, I think as honourable members know, the number seems to be stabilising around 30%. The challenge now is to ensure that we interpret this number correctly. See, with more and more people on antiretrovirals, people live longer. And people living longer means prevalence will go up. So if prevalence goes up in the context of antiretrovirals, it's a good thing. It means people are living longer. And we've got some other data, independent data from researchers, to show that that is indeed true, that people are living longer. And I'll come back to that data later. With respect to provincial breakdown of the prevalence survey, the prevalence rates amongst antenatal attendees increased in 7 provinces. And again, we think this is a consequence of the large-scale antiretroviral program, with the exception of 2 provinces. In KwaZulu-Natal, the antenatal coverage seems to be stabilizing at just under 40% for 2009-2010. But for both 2009 and 2010, KwaZulu-Natal had the highest prevalence rate. So the biggest problem still is in KwaZulu-Natal. I mean, there's no question about that. The Northwest experienced a decline in the HIV prevalence from 30 to 29%. But that's not a statistically significant number. So, you know, it's in the same range. The Western Cape historically has had the lowest HIV prevalence in the country and continues to have the lowest. But you can see that there was quite a big increase in the prevalence rates in the Western Cape. And we think this might be attributable to a larger sample size. So it's a methodology issue rather than a real issue. The 5 districts that recorded the highest prevalence of HIV amongst antenatal attendees, and the highest being over 40%, were all located in KwaZulu-Natal. So it's Amkhanyokude, eThekwini, uMgungundlovu, iLembe, and Ubu districts. So those are the districts which have the largest number of people who are HIV positive. The number of districts recording HIV prevalence rates between 30 and 40% increased from 14 of the 52 districts in 2009 to 21. And again, we think this is related to the antiretroviral program. The district in the country that has the lowest prevalence rate is the Central Karoo, with less than 1% transmission. Moving on to Program 4, which is primary health care, the primary health care utilization rate of 2.5% was achieved in 2011-2012 against a target of 2.6 visits per person. So we're in the right ballpark with respect to access to services. Vitamin A supplementation coverage amongst children aged 12 to 59 months was 43% against a target of 40%. And again, we'll say what we're going to be doing about it to increase that number. Honourable members will recall that the Minister launched a re-engineering of primary healthcare project, which has three streams in it. The one stream is municipal ward-based primary healthcare outreach teams. And we have teams now in 337 wards. And again, I can say more about this later, together with the other two streams, which is a new school health program, which the President launched last Friday, and a program that puts district specialists in every one of our districts. And again, I can say a little bit about that later. With respect to the integrated chronic disease management, honourable members will recall that in our APP, we said we will implement a integrated chronic disease management model in three districts and in three provinces. We have been able to implement this in 41 facilities in these three districts. And again, I can say a little bit more about it, but it's essentially a way of improving access and throughput of patients with chronic diseases through our public health facilities to improve the quality of care they receive, the effectiveness of the care, and the efficiency of the service. And the districts that they've been implemented is the West Rand district in Gauteng, Ehlanzeni in Mpumalanga, and Dr. Kenneth Kawunda in Northwest Province. And the kinds of things they're doing is looking at scheduling chronic patients, giving them appointments, for example, so that they don't have to wait in long queues if they repeat patients, designating consulting rooms for chronic patients, and implementing waiting time surveys to decrease the waiting times that chronic patients wait in queues in our facilities. We also were able to provide a strategic plan for the prevention of injuries in South Africa. I mean, the Honourable Chair mentioned motor vehicle accidents. It's becoming a bigger and bigger problem in our country. And together with the other government departments, we were the lead department in developing an integrated intersectoral strategy with 12 key objectives. The strategy still has to be adopted formally by FOSAD, the Forum of DGs of South Africa. The people that contributed to this strategic framework are the Departments of Basic Education, Correctional Services, Justice and Constitutional Development, Social Development, Trade and Industry, Transport, and we had a range of academic and research institutions who helped us, and we also consulted with some sectors of civil society. Notwithstanding those achievements, there are still a number of challenges with primary health care. And Chair, I would just like to note that district hospitals also fall in this program 4. District hospitals achieved a usable bed utilization rate of 67% against 70%, and this is really a measure of efficiency. And the closer we get to 70% and above, the more efficiently we run our district hospitals. So there's still a number of district hospitals with beds that are not being used. The average length of stay is slightly larger and higher than our target of 4 days at 4.3 days. With respect to PHC supervision, Honourable Chair, you can see we're still struggling with PHC supervision. It's at 66% against a target of 70%. Now, really, there should be no excuse for this not being 100%. The way in which we measure PHC supervision is the number of supervision visits made, and should be at least one a month, to each facility with a written report generated for that visit. So it's quite a strict definition. And the major challenge there is transport. It's always been transport, and it continues to be transport. We've also done a review through the Health Systems Trust on hospital performance indicators to look at whether or not we can, using the indicators we have in the District Health Information System, improve the performance of hospitals. And at a later stage, Dr. Lakalakala might want to say something about that. With respect to Program 5, which focuses on regional, tertiary, and quaternary hospitals and workforce development, which is human resources, the following were achieved in the financial year we're reporting against. We produced a national workforce strategy, which is responsive to the service delivery platform, and we've begun to mobilize resources for its implementation. The strategy was launched on the 11th of October last year, and it incorporates a strategy for rural health force development. We've also done work on norms and standards for the health workforce, for primary health care and secondary health care. And again, we can say a little bit more about this during the discussion. So we did an audit of community health workers, and this is part of the re-engineering of primary health care. And we've developed an NNE plan together with the University of the Western Cape for the outreach program. And again, we can say something about how far we've gone in strengthening our community-based services, because that's really the thrust of that stream of primary healthcare re-engineering. We have historically not had enough technologists, and together with the Tswana University of Technology, we are training 42 technicians that will look at the safety and usefulness of the technology we use, the health equipment that we use. We appointed an external service provider in November last year to develop an integrated project management information system. And the operational rollout of the system and training of the users commenced in this financial year. And again, Mr. Masilela will say a bit more about it later. As honorable members know, without essential equipment in our health facilities, we can't diagnose and treat patients. So we've developed essential equipment lists for clinics and for tertiary hospitals during 2011 and 2012. And during that period, we had only planned to finalize an essential equipment list for primary healthcare, but we've also succeeded in doing one for tertiary hospitals. And again, Dr. Lakalakala can say a bit more about it later. As honorable members know, we submitted to Parliament a National Health Amendment Bill after approval of Cabinet. And there have been ongoing discussions on that bill by both the House of Assembly and the NCOP. Honorable Chair will remember, and members will remember, that we started an audit of all public health facilities, those that belong to the municipalities and those that belong to the provinces. This was done by a consortium led by the Health Systems Trust. That audit has been completed, Honorable Chair. So we know for each facility in the country what the status is with respect to a large number of domains. And improvement plans are currently being put in place to improve those areas that needed improvement in each facility. And again, we can talk about how we're going about doing that. The establishment of the new Pharmaceutical and Related Products Regulatory Authorities, the so-called SAHPRA, was approved by Cabinet, and a draft Medicines and Related Substances Amendment Bill was published for comment for 3 months, which expired in June 2012. The bill aims to strengthen transitional arrangements, including the regulation of foodstuffs, cosmetics, medical devices, and in vitro diagnosis, and to improve the definition of medicines. And again, I'm sure the honorable members have been engaging with this amendment bill, so you know what it contains. With respect to antiretrovirals, and again, Dr. Andrew Pillay will say a bit more about it, because we issued a new tender, we gazetted a new tender last Friday. We are moving towards a single tablet once a day, so six-dose combination for antiretrovirals. And again, we will say how far we are in procuring the new fixed dose combinations for antiretrovirals. There's been numerous complaints. I'm sure the honorable members get complaints regularly about the Medicines Control Council. So a key objective of the department is to streamline and strengthen the registration of medicines and reduce the backlog in registration and reduce the time between the products, between licensing and marketing of these products. During 2011-12, a total of 386 generic medicines were registered within an average period of 34 months. Now again, Honorable Chair, you can see this is way longer than the target of 18 months. So we need to do far more there to strengthen the current MCC. A total of 34 new chemical entities were registered with an average period again of 37 months against a target of 18 months. And again, there are significant delays in the registration of both generics then and new chemical entities. One of the challenges, and we put some of the challenges here, Chair, experienced by the MCC, the lack of evaluators. I think honorable members know that these evaluators are not in the department. we have to buy their time. They are usually sitting in universities. So we have to buy their time. And of course, we are then held hostage to how much of time they can give us and how quickly they can turn around the various dossiers. So we have appointed more technical experts to now assist in fast-tracking some of the registration processes. Either via the presidential hotline or via the department directly, we get numerous complaints about the public health services, and 40% of the complaints have been resolved within 25 days. So we need to do better and try to get 100% of complaints resolved within 25 days. But at the moment, we are sitting at 40%. One of the key challenges, Honorable Chair, is that, as the Honorable Chair mentioned in your introductory remarks, the services are rendered by provinces, and that's where the challenges are. So when the complaints come to the National Department, we have to ask the provinces, in the first instance, to respond. And that often takes longer than the 25 days that we have as our benchmark. We have a database of complaints, and we are using this to more effectively monitor the progress in responding to the complaints. Chair, I will stop there for now. That's kind of a narrative summary of the six program areas. I will hand over now to the CFO to talk about the financials.
Thank you, Chair. I would look at the six programs and also suggest a variance explanation for each of those as presented in the annual financial statements. The first program is obviously administration. The variance that we've recorded in terms of under expenditure was 15.9 million, which equates to 95% of that budget. We've also indicated per program the shifting of funds and the requirements that was considered during the adjustment stage and which then was legislated as part of the new budget. In terms of program two, there was also an underspending of 15 million on this program, and that equates to a 91% expenditure for that program in total. Program three, HIV AIDS, TB and maternal child and women's health, recorded an 87 million rand under expenditure. It equates to 99% of the total budget, as quite a large number of transfers for conditional grants reside within this program. On program four, the under expenditure recorded was 20.2 million. It equates to 97% of total budget. And the biggest underspent there was under your current payments, which equates for your goods and services, as well as your compensation of employees. Program five, again a big budget in that recording an expenditure of 92 million, and 99% of the budget. This program hosts most of the conditional grants, especially on the HR, on the HIG, the Revive grant, tertiary services grant, and the health professional training development grant. Program 6J in total showed 23.9 million rand under expenditure, and that equates to 95% of budget. So on slide 33, you'll see that the total under expenditure for the department equated, as you said, to 255 million. It's 99%, but you still need to account for the under expenditure of the 255. The next slides indicates the same breakdown, but now per economic classification. So we've broken it down. The current payments. So the current payments consist of compensation of employees, as well as goods and services. Compensation of employees has recorded a 15.4 million rand under expenditure, which equates to 96.4% of total budget. The one area that we did not do as well as we should have in terms of goods and services shows an under expenditure of 226.6 million, with only 74% of that budget spent, and I'll talk a little bit about it now. Transfer payments, there's a myriad of transfers, but essentially we've recorded a 8 million rand under expenditure on transfers, significantly to universities and technicons. And this was mainly because of the transfer to
the medical school of this, where there was a lower a lower uptake in terms of the scholarships that were offered, and then on NGOs of 6.1 million, mainly because those plans were not in place at the time of transfer, and we did not have any legal basis of transferring those funds. And payment of capital assets was underspent by 6.7 million. And I'll talk to it now to say what the specific reasons. So on the material variances for administration, as I said, we underspent 15.9 million on the program. It's basically or mostly described to the fact that the supplier could not deliver the IT equipment before year end. We also had a responsibility of making sure that we order these equipment in time, and we've put that process in place now to make sure that we actually put orders before or at the time that it's needed. On goods and services, the funds for the health statistic publication and the provincial support units was not fully utilized. Under Program 2, which recorded also a 15.3 million rand saving or under expenditure with a variance of 91%, is essentially attributed to the low spending on the NHI funds that was received, and that there was some delay in the finalization of all the legislative processes and the consultations. The technical policy planning unit was also not was mostly inactive for most of the year. And the panel of technical experts that we've put in place could not be utilized as intended. But I must say that this panel of technical experts that we put in place is now starting to show some fruit in this financial year. On Program 3, it was essentially the 87 million that was underspent, 99%. We've mentioned, I think Dr. Pillay has mentioned the issue of the condoms and the difficulty there was around the condom tender and the availability of condoms from suppliers. On the next slide here, the underspend on the primary healthcare services was just the delivery of the influenza vaccines. We've taken charge we've accepted most of these vaccines in this financial year, and we've paid for them. On Program 5, the underspend was basically due to the slow start of the nursing college project. That was the one reason. The other reason, obviously, was also the amount that was supposed to have been transferred in terms of the IUSS, the infrastructure support unit, as well as the project management support unit, was not invoiced by our service providers in time, and we could not process those invoices. On Program 6, the 23 million, the underspending was basically due to the fact that there was an establishment, the establishment of the Office of Standards Health Compliance was not finalized by year end, and that had a carry through effect into the current financial year. Chair, as a summary of the audit report as presented by the AG, as you said, we did receive an unqualified audit opinion for the 11-12 financial year. But this is not to say that we do not have matters that need some attention, and I've listed all the matters that we picked up from the audit report. The first matter was that there were some employees that were appointed without following a proper process to verify claims in the applications. It's a compliance issue, essentially. It means that we have to go through all each application, do the security checks, do the background checks. And in some instances, this was not done. The second issue under HR was that not all senior managers that signed performance agreements as required by the public service regulations before year end. And we've actually addressed quite significantly this finding in the current financial year and in the new cycle. The human resource plan was not in place as required by the public service regulation at the time of audit. And even in this case, we've also moved after the finalization of the organizational structure. The human resource plan has been workshopped and is being implemented. There were some other control issues brought in terms of the monitoring of the funds being transferred. The first one was the NGO funding monitoring was not adequate. to ensure that transfers were made or applied for as the intended purpose. The conditional grants monitoring has also come under some scrutiny by the AG. The first one was the monitoring expenditure of, well, the monitoring of the expenditure as well as non-financial information was not adequate for the hospital infrastructure grant, the training development grant, and the tertiary grant as required by DORA. The requirements and responsibilities for the infrastructure grant was not totally adhered to. The transfer payments for HIV/AIDS was not made in accordance with an approved payment schedule. Arrangements for the REVITE grant, the pathology grant, and the HIV grant was not adequately adhered to. And then there was an issue of business plans for pathology and HIV/AIDS that was not approved prior to the start of the financial year. So we've actually analyzed each and every of these findings. We've put in place an intervention plan both for the NGOs as well as for the conditional grants, of which I can leave copies with the Secretariat if you approve. But essentially, Chair, if we deal with these things in this financial year, we should be on our way to achieving a clean audit. Admittedly, our first quarter, we did not address all these issues yet, but I think our plans are in place and our intervention plan is such that we're able to schedule and tabulate each and every activity needed for conditional grant monitoring. And as I said, we've had a number of workshops with line management together with the AG. I think the recommendations is just that we need to further, improve and coordinate communication with the AG. We've put in place a very strong steering committee and audit protocol with them that has helped this process along. And we need to strengthen and maintain that protocol process. We're implementing the strategy to address these findings, especially on HR, NGOs and conditional grants. And issues that we can implement immediately, we're doing so. Others might require processes and policies, but we're continuously addressing those processes. There's a future audit risk, Chair and members, especially on inventory. Inventory is an issue that if it's not being controlled, could easily become a new asset problem. And we've already put in quite a strong team to intervene on inventory. And from our interim audits, it seems that we've covered most of what the AG is looking at, and we've done some proper reconciliations back to system. The last comment I'd like to make on audit, Chair, is that even though assets was not part of a qualification or matters of emphasis, we're definitely not taking it lightly because it's something that can regress quite quickly. And our team has already started doing the reconciliations, we're doing the verifications, and we aim to do at least two or three verifications before year end to maintain the asset position of the year. Chair, I'd like to just briefly run through the conditional grant expenditure as reported, as its impacts on our provincial results as well. The first one is your National Tertiary Services Grant. The total expenditure by provinces was 99% of the budget. What we show in the slide for you is what was accepted as part of the Division of Revenue Act. If there was any rollover adjustments considered at adjustment estimate stage, what was available for transfer, what was the actual transfer to provinces, what was received and confirmed as received by provinces, and then what was spent by provinces. Right? So in this financial year, on all grants, we have transferred all the funds as gazetted by DORA. We've got confirmation that all funds have been received by provinces. The only issue that was raised by the AG in this respect was that we, in some instances, might have transferred it slightly late or outside of the payment schedule that we're addressing that. So on the services grants, you'll find there's a range of expenditures. It's 99% in total. Eastern Cape has recorded 103% expenditure, which is an overspend. But as you know, that on conditional grants, whatever is overspent by a province comes from the equitable share. So the conditional grant expenditure is only extended up to what is being transferred in terms of the Division of Revenue Act. The HIV and AIDS program has shown an underspend of 97%, and I think it relates to some of the issues that was raised by Dr. Pillay on the condoms especially. Some provinces like Gauteng has shown an overspend of 106%, and you've got low expenditure in the provinces like Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Northern Cape of 85%, mainly because the the vendors were not properly registered, and they couldn't make use of the transversal tender. Forensic pathology services also recorded a 99%, and this has been typically been a grant share that's been difficult to manage in the past. We've shown, I think in the past financial years, we've shown some serious underspend on this grant. This grant has come to an end in this financial year. The total expenditure by provinces was 99% of this budget, which is an improvement, at least in terms of future of past expenditure rates. But many provinces need now to make these funds available in the equitable share to maintain this program. Gauteng has shown a 76% expenditure, which is the lowest of the provinces. The Revive grant was at 99% expenditure, but again, it's quite a mixed bag of expenditure across provinces. Eastern Cape has had a significant expenditure of 135%, and we'd like to think that some of this is attributed to the processes we're putting in place to gain momentum on expenditure of infrastructure. But other provinces like Limpopo and Mpumalanga have shown significant underspend. Limpopo only spent 77% of budget, and Mpumalanga 83% of the total budgets. The training and development grants was spent at 101%. Again, provinces like Eastern Cape and Free State was the biggest overspend, and they'll have to carry that against the equitable share. The infrastructure grants, it's also a grant transfer as part of or supplementary to the equitable share, and has stood at 97%. Eastern Cape, again, has overspent those grants at 110%. Pumalanga, the lowest spent at 88%. And see, on all the infrastructure issues, there are interventions that are starting to show fruit, although it's been slow to gain momentum in terms of those expenditures. We also reported, Jay, in the financials on some of the trading entities and public entities related to the National Department of Health. The first one was the MRC, the Medical Research Council. And the funding that we transferred over to this entity was 271.2 million in the 11-12 financial year. We believe that all these entities, well, most of the entities did receive unqualified audit reports, except for the CCRD, which we will talk about now. The next one is the National Health Laboratory Services. The funding that was afforded to this entity was 82.1 million for the 11-12 financial year. The Medical Schemes Council received 4.11 million from the National Department of Health for the year under review. The SANEC is still essentially dormant, although there's now a move to make it its own entity. And we're in the process of putting up a system where we also transfer funds out to them. They've appointed their own CEO, they've got their own CFO, so their processes and systems are getting such that we're in a position to transfer funds out to them in terms of the PFMA. The compensation funds received 2.7 million for the year under review, Chair. But I think more importantly with the CCRD is that we're still finalizing the 10-11 and 11-12 financial years financial statements. And I know that the committee has taken a presentation from Dr. Batty Kisasami. We finalized the 10-11 financial year. There is still some disagreement in terms of the treatment of some of the provisions and liabilities. But we've sought some intervention from National Treasury in terms of interpretation. And I'm sure that's at some stage we'll be happy to present the progress in that regard. So I will leave it there for the financial part. And,
Chair, thanks. Just two concluding slides, Chair. This slide that we put up on the board now, Chair, is where we think some of the impact of our interventions are beginning to show. So the Medical Research Council has just produced a report that shows that against the baseline of 56.5 years, which is the life expectancy at birth, for 2009, at 2011, they estimated to be 60 years. And our target that we had set for 2014 was 58.5 years. So we've already reached the target. So that's good news. And you can see that that is true of both males and females, that males and females in South Africa are now living longer relative to the baseline of 2009. In terms of mortality, the chances of surviving have also increased, which means that the chances of dying have decreased by 10% for both males and females. So you can see and that's one of our NSDA targets, to improve life expectancy. We now have independent data from the MRC that shows that life expectancy is indeed increasing. With respect to under 5 mortality, that's the children under 5 per 100,000 live births, again you can see against a baseline of 56 children per 1,000 live births dying in 2009, the estimate from the MRC is that that's reduced to 42 children per 1,000 live births, and the same with the infant mortality rate, children under 1. 40 was the baseline per 1,000 live births. It's reduced to 30 per 1,000 in 2011. So that's the good news. Life expectancy is increasing, under 5 mortality is decreasing, and so is infant mortality. If you look at maternal mortality, we still don't know what the 2011 data looks like. The WHO and UNICEF estimated that per 100,000 deliveries, we have a maternal mortality rate of 300. Our own experts think it's around 310. And our target for 2014 is 270. Now, the only data we have there, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, is from the confidential inquiries into maternal mortality. They are showing for 2011 a decrease in institutional maternal mortality. Now, that is not reflected in the MRC report, however. Now what I forgot is the neonatal mortality. That's the children that die between when they were born and 28 days after birth. And you can see that that's not improving significantly. It's somewhere between 13 and 14 per 1,000 live births. So we need to do more to ensure decreased neonatal mortality and decreased maternal mortality. And we can say, we share with the Honorable Members also what we're doing in that regard. So it's a bit mixed with respect to neonates and maternal mortality, but with respect to life expectancy, under 5 and under 1s, there is good progress. Much of this, Honorable Chair, is attributable to antiretrovirals, because much of the mortality is contributed by HIV. With respect to maternal mortality, the estimate is that 50% of maternal mortality is associated with HIV, and around 40% of mortality in under 5s, again, attributable to HIV. With respect to to children under 5, the other big contributor is the two new vaccines we introduced in 2010, which is pneumo and rotavirus, right, against pneumonias and diarrhea. And again, the National Institute of Communicable Diseases has some surveillance data that shows that those two vaccines are making a significant contribution to decreasing under 5 mortality. So just those three interventions, then, we think, are leading to increased life expectancy and decreased mortality rates. So in conclusion, Chair, the key milestones that we had set ourselves in our annual performance plan for 2011-12 were largely achieved, and we've highlighted those. We've also highlighted those that we didn't achieve or we came close to achieving. And we reflected on some of the interventions that we have already put in place to address the challenges. And clearly, we are totally focused on these four key outputs of the NSDA: increased life expectancy, decreasing maternal and child mortality, combating HIV and TB, and strengthening health system effectiveness. So we'll stop here. Thank you very much for this opportunity, and I'm sure we'll be happy to engage with the questions that you have.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Department of Health, led by Jorgen. I'm hoping you're not telling us that it's the three interventions that have contributed to the improvement. So it means we don't have to exercise and do all those things. They don't contribute that much, so we can continue eating and remember that is the report. Thank you very much. That is the report from the department. We are supposed to have tea at 11. I'm not sure whether we should start with tea and then come back and engage the department at length. So I see some of the heads are nodding vertically, not horizontally. I only saw one that was nodding vertically. So I want to hear from the others. Should we have tea or should we engage them? I'm told that it is there. Is it there? Okay, apparently the tea is not yet here, so let's continue until we get tea and then we'll see. Welcome, Honorable Dudley. The lady who came late is Honorable Dudley. She's one of the members of the committee. So members, that is the report. By the way, let me remind you again. We are engaging them on what they had done in this past year. But at the same time, we're trying to look with the experience of our constituencies of what we had seen and what they're going to be telling us. We can make recommendations, and at the end of it, you should ask your questions with that idea that should I make recommendations on this? The recommendations are going to come later. But as we ask questions, we should have that we're going to be reviewing the budget and giving a report to Parliament. So we recommend it, but we can recommend. We don't have to. We can if we feel that there are certain areas. Members, it's up to you now to ask questions. I'm looking at your hands. Okay, Honorable Mr. Khaled, I still see you.
Come, Honorable Mr. Khaled, followed by Honorable Khaled.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank the department for the elaborated report. And we should even comment that the annual plan together with the presentation really came on time. We shouldn't only complain when it didn't come on time. We really appreciate it. On page 24 of this, whereby you talk about the main appropriation, the adjustment, actual spend, and the underspending, you're saying to us in this, we shouldn't have adjusted your main appropriation. We shouldn't have done that, because when you minus what you were given and what you have spent, it gives 18 million, the initial 18 million. Now, because we talked to the minister that he must give you more because we are crying, we made you to underspend 255 million. I know CFO, you always tell us that there is a certain amount which you are allowed. I think it's
0.2%.
Yeah. But to me, as a non-financial manager sitting here, as a politician, 255 million is a lot of money. And I cannot justify, because this document is for public consumption. If I didn't ask for why are you have you underspent the billion, 255, I cannot account to a lay person who doesn't have 1, 2, 3 at the end of the day. I sometimes ask ourselves, myself, to be saying that when we sit here, when you go back, what do you do about what we say? Do you have a special meeting to be saying that we are in Parliament and this was said, and you list whatever we have said, and you come up with a implementing mechanism? Or do you just go back and continue as though nothing has happened? I'm asking this term because since I sat here in 2009, and it is long where I come from, where I'm going is very near. I cannot be saying that I'm a new member because I'm just on the exit. And the issue of primary health care. Do you know, I don't understand. I don't. There was an evaluation of managers at the primary health care level. What we call sub-district managers, which you never mention about them in any of your presentation if they exist. There was the evaluation of those posts whereby we were saying that a small sub-district compared to a bigger sub-district, people should be getting remuneration according to the sizes of those sub-districts. And can I tell you, when you go to Northwest, there is another monster calling another name, and that is why at a certain stage when you are sitting here talking, people don't understand what you are saying or talking about, because in Eastern Cape is another structure. When are we going to really see synergy? So that when we compare, because when I'm sitting here, when you compare primary health care, you are comparing apples with orange, because they are management is not the same. Can I really get there? And can I really get a report to be saying, where are you with the management? Because I can really say that with hospital CEO, there is something, because you always talk about. What about that person who's supposed to really give us a very, very good service so that our hospital mustn't overflow? You talk about accrual. I will clearly want to know, how much are these accruals? How are the provinces dealing? Can you really break it down according to the provinces so that we can see how is the people doing? NHI, we know that you said that they are spending, even if they were underspending. Can we really get the picture? Where are the progress? Where we are now? Then you talk about, can we trace this doctor from Cuba? I can see what you are saying, because I want to know, since the inception of this program, where are these people? Are they still with us, or are they gone? Because I'm still having, when I go to the clinic, when I go to the hospital, I really hear about a doctor shortage, more especially in rural places. You find that the hospital is working with one doctor, and that particular doctor is supposed to even go to the clinic. Why Western Cape and Free State's numbers are not here, the Cuban doctor? Why Western Cape, why Free State is not here? I'm very sorry to... the TV. I see that you have really improved. I really appreciate it. knowing where you come from, but I still want to know which is the district or the province, the province and the district, even if we can even go to the sub-district, which is doing best in TB, and which one is not doing well. Can I have that so that we can be knowing which and why are they not doing well, so that we can be helping. You say 100.7% of pregnant women were tested for HIV. 100.7. What does that mean? Because when you are testing everybody who's coming into for antenatal, to me it will be, I'm a lay person, mind you, I did arithmetic, not mathematics, all those things. Now, when I take it from arithmetic point of view, if every woman who comes into the clinic is tested, it will be 100%. Now, the 0.7, where do you get that 0.7? Can you enlighten me? About the condom distribution, do we have a relationship with private? Because you are saying that you are distributing this amount. But what do I know, certain people go and buy as a over-the-counter, wherever. Do we have a relationship so that they can really give us to be saying that how many people are using condom? Because irrespective that they get them from the hospital or from the government or from private, they are using condom so that we can get next to whatever. The second dose of immunization. You said that the first dose they are good. Don't you think that is because of migration, whereby you cannot have the people for second dose? Do we transfer? Do we have what you can say? We transfer people. If after 6 weeks I go to Mpumalanga, is there any transfer? Because I think it will, in the register, it will say this child didn't come back. But that child has moved. Do you have the system which does that? I will skip. There were many. Primary health supervision, 66%. And you have said transport. But in your plan, I don't see where you are going to really improve this, because you were giving me achievement and even recommendation and remedial. How are the pool cars, the subsidized cars? I know that certain employees or managers don't have car. What are you doing about it? Can I have the... Then when we talk about the workforce, you say you have retired nurses. I don't see it. Isn't that it was a strategy? And isn't that at a certain stage you were told that you are doing something? Where are you? Because you don't talk anything about... Can you explain to me this goods and service, which is understanding so much? What in real layman's language you understand good and service, which is understanding so much? Thank you. I'll take another bite if you allow me. It's so much I haven't even touched.
You'll be given another chance.
Please.
You'll be given another chance. Since we're dealing with the core, what we are here for, we're dealing with the main department that was supposed to be oversighting, making laws. It is going to be important that we give today more time. So what I'm requesting is that do we go for lunch, because we don't have lunch prepared for yet, and then we'll come back at 2 o'clock again and continue. So, but I think because I'm looking at your brains, they're not that big. So we'll have to in between give you time to answer, because you'll forget all those things. It's only a few people who can retain information. So you're going to have another bite on another Khaled's side. No. Oh, yes, he'll come back and have another bite. So you have to ask all your questions that you want to ask. That goes for everybody. Welcome, Honorable Robinson. This is the lady who had gone to the doctor. Now she came back because she wants to be seen by the doctor. She remembered that there are doctors in health. So she's going to be seen by you, doctor. We got your apology from Honorable Governor. So sometimes when we ask questions, it's not because we've experienced things. We just ask them because we think. So don't think that Ms. Khaled is right. Had an experience of private condoms. No, she didn't have an experience of private condoms. It's only that she knows that some people go and buy condoms somewhere. She didn't have a real private. Okay, Dadehana. It's going to be Dadehana and Matube and Honorable Dudley.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I think we have got to start by congratulating you on your unqualified audit. And I hope that it's going to be sustainable, quite frankly, because in most cases when things happen like this, you say there's a light at the end of the tunnel. The problem is, which tunnel are you in? as a problem. When you talk about under expenditure, You are raising two components, the goods and services and the capital one. And under goods and services, you raise the issue of health statistics publications, the provincial support unit, hospitals tariff system review, and under capital you talk more about information technology. What I really wanted to know is whether you have got plans in place now to address these things, the areas. Which you have highlighted, and the other point was is the issue of the annual performance plans, where I think it's about you analysed for some or let me put it you assisted all provinces, you are assisting all provinces, but there are other provinces which could not come to the table or which you could not analyze. I'm interested in understanding if you have helped all of them, why others are still behind. And on the issue of the male circumcision, for lack of a better word, I just want to know about whether you have got a marketing strategy. It might sound bad, but I'm sure you understand what I mean. And because one of the problems you are raising is that the availability of doctors were not available to perform this. Are there any plans to involve other health workers in ensuring that this takes place? Because if you are going to market, that means there's going to be more work for the doctors who are not available to perform this. The other point which I wanted to know is you have got only your target for baby-friendly health facilities is 25. Mm-hmm. Why 25? I mean, in a country as big as South Africa, why such a low target? I might not understand what is involved in choosing the 25, but I believe that it's very low. And the issue of in terms of your immunization target, the fact that Western Cape, Northwest, and Mpumalanga did not reach their target, there must be something which made them not reach their target. What it is, and we had discussions with different MECs up to now. And the infrastructure is a serious challenge in all provinces. Specifically, when we spoke to the MEC, when the MEC of Eastern Cape and Mpumalanga, Limpopo, were here, basically what they were saying is that they will never solve the problems which they have in those provinces because there is no money. So I just wanted to check whether the department has interacted with those particular processes. And I mean, Limpopo was in the news now when the MEC was asking everybody to contribute everything. When we were in the Eastern Cape, the provincial treasury was saying there's something wrong with the department. And the department was saying there's something wrong with the treasury, because it's treasury which makes us not be able to do this, because the problem is the problem of accrual and all that. They raised a lot of problems. But we can't be in a situation where we discuss problems permanently. We have got to reach a point where we are saying, now we understand what all these problems are, particularly in these two provinces, and we are now going to take the following steps to take them out of where they are so that they get run as normal provinces. The other point, which is similar to what Honorable Khalid Iswaya asked, is when it comes to HIV/AIDS, in terms of voluntary testing, there are people who pay for their tests in private sector. I always argue that the Department of Health is not a Department of Public Health. It's supposed to be a Department of Health, both public and private. And somehow, private sector statistics must be captured by yourselves. If they don't do it voluntarily, we'll have to legislate to force them to provide you with that particular information. So what I want to know is the number of people who have used their medical aid to get tested, and who are going for their own, who get their own medicines via that particular route instead of, because that's also impact on the, because it does not mean it's free because they need to make their medical aid. And I'm not going to ask any issues about condoms. I think we have got a condoms expert. I'm just saying. The prevalence of HIV/AIDS, I mean, for a very long time, people just talk about the prevalence of KwaZulu-Natal. And there's now, at least I know there's a place where I can go in the Karoo and stay there, I'm safe. But has there been any research about this prevalence? What causes this particular prevalence in KwaZulu-Natal? Because unless we understand what the problem is, we cannot solve it. You can throw all the condoms in KwaZulu-Natal and do everything in KwaZulu-Natal, but if we don't know what we are dealing with, there's going to be a problem. I've got my own views about why there is a problem, but I will not disclose it for in case I visit KwaZulu-Natal and I meet with a stray bullet. The issue of Cuban doctors, I'm not going to ask the same question, but the issue is, I'm sure it's not free. I mean, the Cubans are not welcoming us for nothing. We spend a certain amount of money for the students to be there. When you compare, it was very interesting that one of the reasons why you underspend is because the this university did not have the intake as expected. If we use this money, which we are pumping into Cuba, have we investigated about whether we can take the other students to other countries or in South Africa dealing with I know the problems which was raised about the capacity and all that, but if this university is not, their intake is not, they take fewer people than they were supposed to take, that means that we could have, there's a space. In the past, medical schools told us that, no, it's the issue of space and all that. But if they take fewer, that means there is space. And I'm sure even if our results might not be as good as everybody else, but there must be certain students who could qualify to go into that in those particular universities. I just wanted to check two things. Whether we have been speaking to other countries where we can be able to send students cheaper or more or less at the same price, and whether we have, in terms of all the discussions of with the medical schools, whether there is some innovative ways in which they are going to ensure that we address this particular problem, and then you find answers. The other issue is the MCC performance. Is there a meeting which you have with them on a regular basis to highlight the problem with people who are not performing is that the fact that they are not performing is because they have got enough reasons why they are very articulate in why they are not performing. You know, in most cases that's the case, that they are so articulate and convincing about why they are not performing that you accept what they say because it makes sense. But is it true? It's another thing. So that's really, because we have, since I arrived here, we have been talking about the performance of MCC, but every time they have got a litany of reasons why they are not performing. I've never seen the litany of reasons of how they are going to make sure that they perform. And that's where I've got the problems about them. And there is also a view on academic hospitals that they either be run as an independent entities on their own, and they are allocated enough funds and they account like anybody as an independent entity, or that they be run by the National Department of Health. There are these views. I would like to know whether you have entertained any of the views of how to run the academic hospitals far more better without them being affected by inability of provinces, because provinces will say, no, we must run ourselves. We cannot be told by the national minister. The national minister is our colleague. He's not my boss. If I'm the MEC, he's not my boss. He's my colleague. And the impression that he's the boss is a wrong perception. But then these hospitals suffer as a result of some of the things which happens in those things. As far as provinces which have overspent, because sometimes the people think that they are right when they overspent, but they are still wrong, because the chances of them falling into a trap of accruing are high, and at a later stage they will be in the same situation as Eastern Cape, because they spend and spend and they overspend and they are overspending and up being a problem to them. I really want to know whether those particular provinces have been warned that this is not a good thing which you are doing. The other point which I want to ask, I don't want to come to the second point. It's really my last question but one, Chair. If you are becoming... I've tried to look into your report. I don't pick up this thing. I know that a lot of the provincial department has been sued by different people for different reasons. And nobody says whether they have budgeted for it, and if they have not budgeted for it, where do they get the money to pay those? But I know they have been paid. I really want to know whether there is a strategy to manage that and how to deal with it. And I will not ask questions about how much was spent and all that. But I'm really worried, because that's something which we are not looking at, but it's happening. And then by the time it rests its head, we then say, hey, we have been hit by something we are not aware of. Especially the causes, and whether people take responsibility. You know, usually in the private sector, people must take responsibility. If you do something as a person, you must take responsibility for that. In the public sector, I don't know whether people take responsibility for their action, or the government just take responsibility for that. And I'll be more interested in which provinces are being sued more than others. Which are those provinces which are being sued more than others? That's my last question.
Thank you. Maybe I'm told that the tea is around, but I wanted to suggest, you can switch off your gadget. I wanted to suggest that let's continue with the question. So if people want to go and drink, they can go and drink and come back quietly. Matube, can you allow me to finish, restate that side, and then we come this way? So it's going to come to you. So let me start with the Honorable Kopan, and then we come to Uzal, and then we come to you. By the way, before you come, don't take it that Honorable Khanare, he wants to go to the Carlos. The Northern Carlos. Not because he doesn't use condoms. He I mean, it's the policy of government. He uses the, but he likes that place. That,
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation by the department. My question, I'm going to challenge Dr. Khanaru when he was saying that there's a, somebody who's a specialist regarding the condom, but I'm going to be a specialist also. I just wanted to find out regarding the awarding of that tender. One of the things that is coming here is that the National Treasury, there's a litigation against National Treasury regarding this awarding of tender. May you kindly just clarify further to us why was that a legal action regarding the against the department? Second to that, why there was a failure to appoint this communication consultant for HIV/AIDS, because that is the reason that you stated here. But when you were explaining about this tender, you didn't specify exactly why there was a failure also to appoint this person here. My other question is regarding on the forensic laboratory. According to the previous annual report, the department recognized that the forensic laboratory should be an integral part of the investigation and criminal justice process. And they also feel that there is a need to improve some sort of a cooperation between the, that is, to improve cooperation between forensic laboratory, forensic mortuaries, and police and justice. I want to find out how far are you with the progress, because on this new, the current report, you don't say anything in terms of the progress, what is it that you are doing. And one of the things that came out very strongly regarding this forensic laboratory, the department stated that there's a challenge in terms of the lack of personnel in the forensic chemistry laboratories. What did you do to improve the situation? Lastly, regarding that, it was also stated that Johannesburg, the infrastructure was also not suitable for that laboratory. What have you done to improve the situation? My second question is regarding the human resource management. That is on page 101. But our CFO, we also mentioned, it came also under audit outcome, that some of the employees were appointed without following the proper processes. And not all senior managers, they didn't sign their performance agreement. I want to find out who is held accountable for all this mistake. Is there anybody who is being held accountable? There's any disciplinary hearing? What has happened? If maybe we can be told about that. While we're still talking about the HR, if you look into page 184, maybe you can clarify to us, there's a table 2.2, if you can just clarify here, that table 2.2, under total personnel cost for the department, including goods and transfer, there's the same amount down until the same total. If maybe you can just explain to us, maybe is it an error or what is happening? My other question, Chairperson, is regarding the Medical Research Council. The last financial year, that's for 2010-2011, the department budgeted about 276 million, but this current financial year, there is a decrease to 271. So I wanted to find out why there is a decrease in terms of the budgeting for this year. Regarding the Medical Research Council again, there's a point that is coming out clearly, even from the previous financial year, where the department said that Medical Research Council, the biggest challenge was to play a pivotal role in supporting the country, national and the provincial Department of Health in achieving the performance target. That is what's being said now. Even the last annual report, it is still the same sentences. Is it copy and cut and paste? It's still the same thing. So I want to know if this is an issue from the previous financial year, if it's still existing here again, what is it that you are doing to make sure that the Medical Research Council is playing that pivotal role of making sure that the department achieve their performance target as you wish? What is it that you are doing instead of just keep on writing over and over? My other concern, Chairperson, is on page 134 of this annual report, is regarding the consultant. I just wanted to find out regarding this consultancy fee that is so high, because the last financial year, that is 2010-2011, the cost, it was 99 million, whatever, and then now it is, there's an increase now. Second to that, many times as the department, they appoint consultants, but I want to know in terms of the skills transfer, can we just maybe say that so much of how many employees there's been a skills transfer, why there was such a need to employ so many consultants, or was it because your vacancy rate is also high? If maybe you can just explain to us. The other thing, Chairperson, that I'm worried about is about the irregular expenditure. If you can check in page 143, it's almost a list of the irregular expenditure. Some of them, there's a list that shows that how many of the issues are under investigation. If maybe we can be given a guideline of when those investigations are going to be finalized, because others, they appear as far as 2009, but they still exist. I just want the clarity on that. The other thing, Chairperson, is regarding the under the legislative changes on page 25. It talks about 104 regulations that were made publicly and then how many others have been completed. Many times, many departments, they come with regulations. But my problem is this, most of these regulations, we never had any scientific evidence to show why the impact of those regulations that are there, even others that are being introduced, why are they introduced? What, I just wanted to find clarity regarding that. Or are we just chasing the numbers? Do they serve any purpose? I just wanted clarity on that. One of the other things, Chairperson, on page 96, the department shows that how they've achieved immunization coverage, about 95.2%. That was good. But somehow, when you read in the annual report, it says that there was an under expenditure. It shows that there was a delay in the delivery of the immunization. How did you manage to cover this 95.2 if somewhere there was a delay in the delivery of the immunization? Was it a specific immunization or what is it? If maybe you can clarify to us, because it didn't make sense to us. Chair, lastly, I just wanted to make it there. Maybe the department can just tell us, or they can just comment, because one of the things that the Auditor General says to the committee when they were doing presentation, they clearly say that the root causes of all what they said regarding the department is mostly, let me talk about accountability. They say that there is a lack of consequences on poor performance in the department. Why are we not doing anything to the people who are failing the department? And secondly, there's a lack of consequences on the transgressors. People, they do whatever that they like, but at the end of the day, nothing is happening. Why are we not changing the situation? The other thing, Chairperson, lastly, is about the people. He talk about this, if you check, we talk about so many under expenditure. One of the things that they highlighted is that there's a lack of financial and a performance management skills within the department. Why are we not employing the people who are relevant, who can make the situation to change? I will end up with that, Chairperson. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Honorable Mseli, there's something that says in Western Cape, the prevalence of TV is very high. And between which is HIV is very low. It doesn't look as if it's balancing, I don't know, but it's something that we need to find out. Okay, Honorable.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks to the department for the unqualified audit report that you have given us. But although you have some challenges in some places, just like to improve for the infrastructure in some rural areas, it's not good. and also to keep on monitoring the clinics, monitor the distribution of the resources in all the health centers, that is clinics, hospitals, and all that. Do you have any plans to improve the, what I have said in future? My question is here. It's just some comments there. My question is, what are you going to do about those provinces which still have more people with HIV and AIDS and TB? Do you have some provisions that you have prepared to help where possible? Thank you.
Thank you. You remember she said when she introduced herself, she was coming from KZN.
Mm-hmm.
So you should understand some of the questions. Honorable Dube.
Thanks, Chairperson, and maybe thanks to the department for especially the unqualified report. We wish next year it must be a clean audit report, because we mustn't just say because 2-3 years back it was unqualified. Let's work towards a perfect report, because Mr. Mahuka said, if you did it, why can't I did it? So, but all in all, thanks for that. But there's a but after the unqualified. I just want to find out which is probably a constitutional problem of the money that you distribute to our provinces. If you get unqualified and then you took all the monies down there, do you monitor or do you check as to how do they spend those monies? And because we are all having TVs, and in most cases we watch TVs, The reports that we see on TV, it's not like the unqualified report around provinces, which is part of us. How do we manage that, and what is it that we can do? But going further also, it's around our municipalities. As members, most of us have constituency offices, and I know my colleague is a good person who can always tell us about primary health care. I am a patient to primary health care. So I want to check, because that was a bad experience that I've experienced during this recess, that most of our clinics in Tshwane are complaining about lack of medicine. So as the department, there's a middle layer and the third layer. Who do we go to around those, you know, complaints that we get? Because there are local clinics and provincial clinics. And there was also a statement that was uttered by the deputy minister of the non-negotiable medicines. Mm-hmm. I am maybe not informed, or maybe I might be ignorant. It's somewhere, you know, kept maybe in my laptop or around the shelves in my offices. Can I maybe be provided with those non-negotiables? Because she was talking of medicine and equipment, but also because we have hospitals and clinics, which ones belongs to where? Because those shelves were empty, and people have been, you know, told, come, and it's frustrating a lot of people, as we want to achieve the primary health care, and people are there, but, you know, there's from our side, we don't provide. When there was also a problem around Tshwane with the pilot project. Unfortunately, I was in that meeting, the province was saying it's this hospital, other people were saying it's that hospital. Can we also get the lists when we talk of pilot projects around our provinces as to where are they, their names and their locations? As a layman, I just want my chairperson to help me. Do we have an MDR-TB or MDR. Okay. When I visited those clinics also, there was a complaint around the not the patients, but the families around people who have been transferred from Tshwane towards Benoni. That was the only... about traveling. I think we are having some 1-2 white elephants of clinics. As the department, don't you think that if possible, those white elephants hospitals can be used? Because it's like, I don't know, maybe around housing it's only one, or if there are many, but from Tshwane to Sizwe, people were complaining about the traveling. And the approach, well, that one is that everybody knows about it. And oh yes, also around the issues of immunization. I know that in my constituency, I'm trying to get the health workers, because I think we are having a lot of health workers around HIV and AIDS. I don't know whether it's because people are getting funds from the government, whereby you find three entities in one community dealing with one issue. Your role to help these people to belong to a particular group, maybe in one township, the sponsor must go to a bigger, how do I call it? You know, these community-based organizations, yes, that are dealing with one thing, but they are smaller nyana. We are trying to bring them together, and they are all getting money from the department, but they don't report to anybody as to what is it that they are doing. So what is it that we can do to help you as a department to bring all those health workers in one pool, and for you to distribute, maybe allocate them some specific, because now we are talking about health, you are talking about immunization, follow-up, we are talking about TB. As we know that our nurses and doctors are very few in those clinics, can they be utilized in a way that they will bring production in our communities? I think that is nearly what I wanted to say, Chairperson.
There is something that I think Honorable Kopan talked about, MRC. MRC has always been complaining that they don't have enough money. And they get donor funding, a lot of it. Now, the worry with that is that you always respect to give you more money. Now, if they get more money from somewhere, they'll report better to that person than it's something that needs to be considered. Honorable Dudley, you'll be there.
Thank you. Thanks for the report. Just looking at the unsatisfactory postnatal care situation, perhaps you could unpack for us a little bit there about why it's so unsatisfactory, what we're doing at the moment and what should we be doing, or what the problems are. Is it connected in any way to the neonatal mortality not decreasing? And then connected to the postnatal care, obviously, for in terms of babies, depression in moms, particularly in formal settlements and things like that. Are we focusing in any way on making sure that postnatal care can actually be kind of aware of possible depression and things, you know, to be able to deal with or help that person deal with what's perhaps in referrals or whatever. And I think since Mental Health Month or something, and depression is the key word right now. Also linked to that, you know, when I had my first son, who will be heading for 40, circumcision, when you have a baby, it was just the norm. They got, you were told they would be circumcised on a certain day, and you had, and you just held your breath and did it. When you have a choice, no mom actually wants a knife to come to her baby. So when you have a choice, you're looking for reasons why not to do it. So I'm just, you know, when you speak about circumcision, are you only speaking about adult circumcision? Are you speaking about doing it when there's babies? I don't think it's that easy in this day and age. I know my next two sons were not circumcised, so I found a way to let it not be important. So something has to happen in terms of the antenatal classes for moms to start sowing the seed for why we are thinking that perhaps it is important in this day and age. So I'm just wondering how much thought has gone into that, so that it becomes a norm, and then have the physicians available. Because I know even when my daughter had her first baby in the UK, just trying to find out how to do it, who would be available, just sent all over the place. Eventually, it's nice and easy just not to do it. So that's a thought. The NGO monitoring, is this an ongoing problem that we've always had in terms of not being able to monitor, or have we suddenly taken a dive? It's obviously a very complex issue, and, you know, to either get the work done or not get it done, and are we going to be able to handle that in terms of what came up in the auditor's report? Then the audit findings around HR. Now, the big debates at the moment are all around vacant positions. Why are the positions vacant? What is going on? What is making it easier for those positions to stay vacant? What has to happen to make sure they don't? Because obviously we would assume that service delivery is going to improve if all the positions are filled. And there also seems to be a kind of a thing. If people will say that it's because of budget, but you kind of assume that there's only those positions would have been budgeted for. So I don't know if you can help us get a bit of a handle on that, just from your experience in the department. And then lastly, just to touch again also on the registering of generics, because I don't think that's kind of a new problem either. And as was said earlier by a colleague, it does make sense. You kind of get the reason behind it, but we've been going, it's an awful long time now, to not see any change in that area. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable. I'm sure did you notice that some of them were surprised when you said your child giving birth. They look at you and they think that you shouldn't be having a grandchild. there is something you talked about, circumcision not reaching the target. There's somebody who wrote an article that those who are circumcised at a certain age, they don't enjoy sex. I don't know whether that is true or not. But it's something that needs to be explained, because there's that perception that those who are circumcised for a long time, for so many years, they don't have the sensation or something like that. But it's something that probably needs to be discussed. The depression that has been mentioned. If you look at all the African languages, there's no term. I've tried to look in Sotho, Xhosa, Zulu. There's no term that talks about depression. There's no word for depression. So sometimes it becomes difficult to explain to somebody that, look, you might be depressed after giving birth. But somebody might correct me. But in Xhosa, there's no word for depression. The only thing that they know is that you've been bewitched by so-and-so not to love your child or something like that. So it's something that you need to consider. Members, you'll be the last one. After that, not the last, but after you, we'll just have a five-minute break. Which one is true? Something in what I've said is true. It's okay. Okay, remember this.
Chairperson, in my province, thank you for the presenter also, when we were talking about the qualified report. In my province, when I looked the highlight this morning, they are going to explain why they are under expenditure for lots of money. And then, I don't know, maybe it's part of this report. And my question is on page 8, slide 10. On that question, I want to know if is the reason for department not to reach their set target. If I ask the question and it's already questioned, because I'm a slow learner, I'm asked apology. Then I will repeat the other question so that I can understand myself. And on the other question is that what were the reasons for the annual National Health Plan not printed at table before the National Health Council? And can department explain to us for the current situation as far as the restriction of the male condoms and what was the root cause of the delay for the registration of service providers? Then my last question was that what has been done to rectify the underspend and preventing it from the UK? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much. There's something about irregular expenditure and unauthorized expenditure. I think that thing talks to the underfunding of the Department of Health. Because health has got those emergencies where the little bit said there's cholera, there's this, and you've got to quickly try and collect money and put it somewhere. So maybe you'd need to explain far much more as to how much does health need to say health is not underfunded, so that we can argue being informed when we argue with the Treasury or whoever, so we can explain that, look, this department is definitely underfunded, but it must be a situation where those who get that money will be able to chew it, not to ask for money only to find that they're not going to chew. About the condoms, you're talking about 6 million condoms, females. The males is
400 million.
What informs you? How do you think of that figure? Is it a figure that you just think, or you equate it to the number of sexual activities per person in the 5 million that we have, taking note that there are babies that are not indulging. But how do you get that figure? Can we go for a 5 minute break and then come back and then you answer some of that 5 minutes break?
Thank you. Thank you.
clearly, we would like to work harder to get a clean audit in this financial year. what we've decided, Honourable Chairperson, is to cluster the questions. So I'm going to ask the CFO to answer all the questions that deal with finances. The BDG for Corporate Services will answer all the questions on human resources and litigation around legislation. Ms. Matsal will answer the questions around the Cuban doctors. I will answer all the program questions. And Dr. Anvin Pillay will answer questions on the MCC, MRC, and drugs, with their shortages and all of that. And then Ndina Papudi will answer the questions on infrastructure. And Mr. Thulani Masilela will answer the questions on the planning, on the ATP and the annual national plan, why wasn't it submitted to the NHC, and a few questions around performance monitoring and what we're doing to strengthen performance monitoring. So I think it's best to start where the money is, so we'll start with the CFO.
It's all about money.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure if I perhaps should wait for the member, because she's the first questions, I think it was the one she asked, which was quite good, about should they have been given any adjustments, and maybe I'll defer that one.
No,
she
was
asking on
behalf of all of us. Thank you. Okay. He's not expert that he met your threat. Right, thank you, sir. The first question, which is very practical, is should we have taken any adjustment, seeing that we've actually spent close to our initial budget? I think it's a fair question, and the answer is basically this, that in the adjustment stage, we do what we call an unexpected and unforeseen, and we request rollovers from the previous financial year. And in many cases, or in some cases, we do receive funds for rollovers and what we regarded then as unexpected and unforeseen expenditures. I think where the difficulty comes is that some of the earmarked funds that have been in the system and in the budget sometimes do not get spent as we would foresee it being spent, and this is then part of the various explanations that are there. So although it might seem that we should not have got an adjustment, I think the specific adjustments was for specific areas of the budget, like rollovers, conditional grants, unexpected, unforeseen expenditure. But I think the point is well taken. The issue of accruals, per province, we could go back and do an analysis of all the accruals per provinces. But what we've realized this last sort of year, when we interacted with especially Gauteng and Eastern Cape, is that doesn't seem to have a proper grip always on the accrual number. So Gauteng, for instance, would report an accruals of 2.7 billion in financials. But as soon as you start to engage them, you find that the actual accruals might go up to 4 billion or 3 billion. So it's a very sort of fluid number. Eastern Cape has consistently reported around 1.8 billion in accruals, which is also part of what they make to be their pressures. The national department has actually been able to reduce the accruals from 60 million to about 24 million in the current financial year. And I must say we are happy to report that the AGS has validated each and every item, each and every invoice that we put up as an accrual. The other question was the goods and services, and exactly what does that saving constitute. In the current year, I'll give you the broad numbers. You'll see that the biggest expenditure was on goods and services for this financial year. The issue of the vaccines contributed around 20 million of that, and this is typically an earmarked fund. It was earmarked for that.
Influenza,
yeah. So if it doesn't get spent, you have to then either carry it forward or make a case for it in the new financial year. The second one was, I think, some procurements on the condoms, as Dr. Pillay has explained. And the other big one was obviously the infrastructure support unit. We were not billed for that by the service provider in time. And those three make up close to 90% of the total expenditure or saving that the goods and services that goods and services has shown. The issue of maybe Dina will also take it up, but I just want to talk to the infrastructure and provinces saying that there's no money on infrastructure. We actually, especially for the provinces like Limpopo, it was mentioned, I mean, we would understand why that's the case, because they've shown significant underspend in terms of the infrastructure. We know this year, through interaction with the provincial departments, that Eastern Cape, Free State and KZN has made a case for additional funding on the infrastructure grants. We were able to secure funding through the adjustment stage for Free State and KZN. But because Eastern Cape's expenditure at the end of the second quarter was not assisting us in making a case for Eastern Cape to get additional funding, President did not consider those funds. So the point I'm trying to make is that although some might say there's no funds, we consistently interact with them, we consistently look at the expenditure, and we even move funds between provinces if needed. And in this case, specific case, we've been able to intervene. The other issue, Chair, that is really kind of haunted us was that when the funds get into the province as a conditional grant, it gets taken up into the entire cash flow of that province. And sometimes provinces use these funds for purposes not intended for. So if they've got big pressures on laboratory or whatever, you find some of the cash moving towards that. So we've really requested provinces and provincial treasuries through our MTEC process that they need to find a way of ring-fencing all conditional grants. And Gauteng has started doing that to some extent. The question about provinces that overspent, yes, we've engaged them continuously. We're putting up a process through our CFO forum. We would like to monitor the IYM and the non-negotiable expenditure, and I'll talk about the non-negotiables in a second just to give you an idea. But you would find, like KZN, for instance, last year they had a large underspend. This year they've overspent to some degree, and we've seen that some of the accruals that have sort of not been dealt with in the previous year has now come through in this year, and this contributes to some of the over expenditures. The issue of high consultancy fee, yes, I think we've looked at that. I can speak, for instance, on the asset management that we've done in terms of the consultancy, is that we've made sure that there's a proper skill transfer between the consultants and the asset staff. So there is some degree of transfers, and maybe Dr. Pillay will still add to the consultancy fees and how we transfer the skills. The irregular expenditure is also kind of a project that we've taken on, in terms of even from last financial year. And although our irregular expenditure has reduced year on year, there's still a lot to be done. And we've agreed with the AG that we would list some of the expenditures that are listed here are things that needs an investigation, even at the National Treasury kind of stage. But I think the point that was made is that we need to look at the old irregular expenditures. So there's expenditures coming from 2001 up to about 2008-09, which is relatively old. So we've established the process of looking at it from a financial point of view, from a labor point of view, and all aspects where the DG has got delegation to condone, those would be given to ourselves. In some cases where Treasury has to condone, we need to put up a bigger case and a bigger history of events. But that process is ongoing, and I'm definitely confident that we'll address probably not all of the regular expenditure, the previous ones, but definitely the bulk of it by the end of this financial year. The issue about the root cause of accountability and what needs to be done for people who transgress, I think Tiny will speak to that. The issue of, and this is one issue I think that the man has raised about the funds that goes to provinces and how we monitor it in terms of conditional grants. So our conditional grant frameworks are pretty tight in terms of what needs to be reported, when, what reports are needed, and all of that. But we still find deficiencies from a national point of view where our conditional grant managers do not always do it exactly in terms of those frameworks. And also the monthly and quarterly reports. If you get a report, it's important for us to interrogate the report, see what the gaps are. So those are all part of the monitoring, the bigger monitoring of conditional grants. And I would like to think that we've moved some way this last few months in trying to address it continuously. But Chair, to be honest with you, if we put just a few things in place here. We should be able to address this in terms of what the AG wants, in terms of what the DORA requirements are. The issue of non-negotiables, man. You're right that we've embarked on this issue of non-negotiables. We've identified about 18 components of non-negotiables. I will leave this presentation as well with the secretariat because it's quite an elaborate thing. But we've identified, say, the 18 components of non-negotiables. And within each component, we've identified the exact standard chart of accounts, the item codes that address that component. So let's say we talk about infection control, then you would see that within infection control, there's about 5 items or 6 items that address that. And the idea with that was to get uniformity across provinces. So when we report on the same thing. Now, not to say that this thing is all rosy. We still have issues in terms of how provinces capture budgets, how they report against them. Some of them that own the numbers, you know, that kind of thing. But at least I think the principle is getting there. We're really monitoring the non-negotiables. And if you remember that the very initial reason why we put up the non-negotiables was because many suppliers complained of not being paid, like your laboratory services. There was also issue of the stockouts. So coupled to each and every component, we've identified the procedures and the policies and whatever that needs to go with a non-negotiable. So I'll make that available for you. Okay, I think if I haven't missed anything, I think those were the major financial points that were raised.
Okay, before timely chair, I think the two things I wanted to add to the CFO's report is one is that on the conditional grant, the DG has appointed DDGs to be champions for it. So in terms of accountability now, it's been lifted from cluster manager, from the chief director to DDGs. So each DDG that's responsible for a conditional grant has to take personal responsibility to ensure that all the things that the AG has reflected in the management report are indeed resolved. So I think that's an additional accountability mechanism we've put in place on the conditional grant. With respect to support to provinces, the newly appointed COO in her branch, she's also responsible for support to provinces, and maybe at some point we will ask her to speak to the kinds of support we envisage providing to provinces, because as you were saying, you know, that's where the action is. Are you going to say anything now or later? Or later. Okay? All right, so can
thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you, Acting DG. Members, I will address a few questions, I think about 4 or 5 of them. The first one, I will respond half of it, and then Dr. Pile will deal with the primary healthcare part of it. It is related to what the member asked about the evaluation of sub-district managers. My response on that one is that at national level, we have a project that is looking at, we don't want to standardize, but we want a uniform structure. Members might be aware that last year in November, the national department reviewed structure was approved by Minister of Public Service and Administration. So based on that structure, we are now working with the provinces to ensure that they follow the same high-level structure. So we are working with the provinces to ensure that there is uniformity. To some extent, maybe some standardization. Dr. Pile, when he presented, he also talked to the norms and standards. It's related to that process also. So that at a clinic level, the acting Dr. Pile. Oh. Yes. So that at some stage, we know that at a clinic, in terms of the norms and standards and the staffing ratios, these are the levels and the number of people or personnel per clinic or per unit. At district hospital, this is what will happen. At tertiary, and just like that. So we are busy with a process. With the staffing norms and standards, we are being assisted by WHO. And then the generic structure process, we are assisted by DPSA. Both these two projects, we are hoping that they will be concluded by March next year. for implementation the following year. So I'm not sure if I would cover the primary health care part of it, so Dr. Pillay can assist. Jorgen, maybe I should say Jorgen. Okay. There was a question related to litigation, ma'am, that is there a strategy for us to address litigations? Most of the litigations where the minister is also cited as a respondent are actually from province level, because that is where the work is being done, where mistakes are done, where allegations are made. So at national level, it's one of the many regulations that the member asked about, why do we do that? There is a process we're busy with. We will put a draft bill next year, in the next financial year, where we want to regularize, if I can use that word, regularize and maybe standardize the litigation mechanisms at provincial level. Because at the moment, at province, negotiations are done at that level, at provincial level, depending on the legal person in a particular department. So there's not uniformity necessarily. So people do things the way they understand them. So we want to guide the process from national so that everybody follows the same process. And we want to have a national fund to that effect and capping of litigations to say, for this particular procedure, if it went wrong, this is how much you can pay, nothing beyond that. So we are in a process of doing that, and members will be informed at the appropriate time how far that process is. So that takes us to the question of, in terms of our annual report, why do we have those 19 legislative frameworks that we amended? Is for the reason of, for instance, you might find that there is an act out there that we're implementing, then suddenly there are problems with the implementation thereof, either raised by the communities or the public at large, or the department has reviewed its mechanisms. So those are the reasons why. To give an example, last year we members, as the acting DG said, are aware of the process of the health bill. It's part of the 19. And then we also tabled, published regulations related to health technology for essential equipment list to the SAPRA, the MCC, the review of the amendment of how the MCC will function in future, the Office of Standards. All of those, they fall under the 19. So it is as and when the need arises. Member asked the question related to page 184 of table 2.2. Clarity regarding that 409 million. That figure, why it's common for all the levels, is the actual total expenditure of personnel for the year. So you can cross-check it with table 2.1, the third column. It shows how much we spend for compensation of employees. So we took that figure, it's a template. Ne? We took that figure to say for every level you calculate against the total, so it will be the same right across. That is why it's the same number all the way. Okay, the PMAs, yes ma'am, we do take disciplinary action. We write letters after numerous reminders. So after the third reminder, we don't remind anymore, we just write a letter of warning. Firstly, we inform the minister, so that minister knows who are the non-compliers in terms of the signing of the PFM, the performance management agreement. And then we refer the matter to labor relations, and they get letters of warning. So it will be first warning, second warning, third warning, trouble. And no, of course, in fact, that is in terms of compliance with the regulations from DPSA. Anybody who has failed to submit their performance agreement on the deadline, we will review their performance, but there won't be any remuneration. It's a standing practice. Okay. I think there's only one last, the vacancy rate. With that one, I would like to respond to it in twofold. For national health, I might say that maybe it's an easier question, because we were reviewing the structure. Structure, as I said, was approved last year. We started with the levels, the DDG level, to implement. All of them were advertised, so we are in the process of finalizing the appointments. Then we are at the level of chief directors. All of them have been advertised, and we're busy with the recruitment. We are now at the level of directors and below. And it's a massive exercise, that one. So we hope to finish that exercise by the end of the year. However, we are always mindful of the fact that we can only fill a vacant post based on availability of funds. That is the national part, which is a bit easy. At provincial level, the provinces have serious challenges. Because, firstly, which I forgot to mention, even for national, we have undergone the process of what we call petal cleanup, which is driven by the DPSA. To say, if your vacancy rate, so that we correct the vacancy rate here. We know that here we correct, we said our vacancy rate is 24%. You will realize that by the end of this year, it would have changed dramatically, because we have cleaned the vacancy rate data to say all the posts that have been vacant for more than 6 months or a year, we regard them as redundant. Then we abolish them from the system in consultation with the relevant DDG. And then we monitor the vacancy rate in terms of whether the money is available or not to fill the post. If the funding is not there, it changes the scenario totally. We're not going to report a vacancy which is not funded. So of the 1.9 total, post, 1.8 at the end of March last year, we are now at 1.3 filled posts. And we are finalizing how much we really have after the adjustment budget in terms of filling vacant posts, so that we change the percentage of vacancy rate. So that process is being done also at provincial level. So for the provinces, we had to abolish close to 120,000 posts. And this is information that we received from the provinces, because they had to go and abolish any post that was not funded. Some of them, those that they still need as critical, they put them on a separate database so that they don't lose track of those posts, so that they wait for availability of funds and then they put them back in the live personal data. So it's a critical process that we are busy with. So the percentage of vacancy we are managing now, but the challenge is availability of funds. However, based on the fact that we are cleaning up the personal, it will change the picture completely. Because on average now, the provinces have indicated the highest percentage rate of vacancies between 24 and 25. Most of them now are below, based on the availability of funds. Thank you. I think I have... Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, just two things to add. With respect to the district managers and sub-district managers, there are a number of courses that universities are running, mostly masters in public health. And a significant number of district managers and sub-district managers have enrolled into those MPH courses. In addition, the University of Pretoria, together with Fort Hare and Harvard University, are in the process of finalizing some curriculum to train and to have courses for district managers. They've even given the program a name. I think it's the Albertina Sisulu Health Managers Leadership Course. And the third course that we are planning is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They have a district management training program. So we're meeting actually on Monday and Tuesday together with other stakeholders, all the universities, to see how we can package that particular course. So there are a number of courses for district managers. The key thing, though, is to ensure, one, that they have the environment in which they can use the information that they get from these courses, and secondly, that they are supported from the province. With respect to the litigation issue, ma'am, in addition to what Ms. Rainier had said, no, there are two broad categories of litigation. The one is poor quality of care and therefore medical negligence, or the allegation of medical negligence, and the other is where unsuccessful bidders take us to court. So on the medical negligence, we are doing a number of things to improve quality of care. And when I talk about the primary healthcare re-engineering, I will give you some examples of what we are doing concretely and what we have already done concretely to improve quality of care to reduce the number of incidents that may be called medical negligence. Can we hand over to Ms. Matsal?
And honorable members, I will attempt to respond to honorable Khalid Swai's concerns, particularly regarding the training and the distribution of doctors, South African doctors from Cuba, trained in Cuba. Yes, it is true that in most instances, the doctors would not be as visible as one might want to see, simply because of the numbers. Remember when this program started in 1997, which means the first graduate came in 2004, that only 80 students for the whole country are taken. Consistently we've been offered the scholarships for just 80 students. And that actually means around 10 students per province for those provinces that are participating. And those go back to the areas from which they came. So while you may not see them in all rural areas, if you go to an area that submitted a student for training, then you will find that student there, that qualified doctor there. I think that has just been a function of the numbers that could be taken by Cuba. For the first time this year, Cuba has opened up places for South Africa for 1,000 students. That would be at around 100, 120, 125 students per province. Unfortunately, it comes at a time when generally the provinces are cash-strapped and therefore are unable to take up this offer. The difference between what Cuba is offering now and what it has always offered is that in the past, they gave full scholarships to the students. All you needed to do was provide a student that was capable, that would have been assessed to be capable, but who couldn't get into the medical schools in South Africa because either they just didn't have the funding or but for whatever reasons that the universities thought they couldn't accept them. Now, what happened was it's a full scholarship, and I want to emphasize that because there's a perception in the public that these students are being paid for by the South African government. These students are not being paid for by the South African government. What it was is that at that time when this was negotiated between our previous president, Mandela and Fidel Castro at the time, I think the president then said it would be so embarrassing for a country like South Africa just to go and milk a country like Cuba without even paying anything. So the agreement was that the students would go on a full scholarship, but South Africa would donate some kind of money. It's a minimal amount, I mean, compared to what it would cost if it was training. Now, for the first time, we've been asked to pay for that training. And it's going to be 1,000 students. We've been battling to raise 1,000 students. The students are there. The kids have qualified, got good metrics, and are poor, and therefore come from the right environment. But we've even said, even those that are not poor, if they can afford to pay for themselves, then they should go. So that's the program we are pursuing now. The 80 scholarships, the standard scholarships, have already left. And in bits and pieces, we are processing the sending of the 1,000 students. Now, as I've said, the problem is provinces can't pay for them. If a lot of provinces can't send more than 50, 60 or so. KZN is the only province that has been able to raise about 400 and something, nearly 500 students, and because they're taking now from, you know, they're taking spaces from those spaces that cannot be taken up by other provinces. and paying the money for them, and paying means transport, vacation time, everything that's to do with students, the provinces need to pay. Not all the provinces, and certainly not Eastern Cape, Limpopo, they've already declared. And unfortunately, they're the provinces with the highest need, but now their provinces do not have the money, and the students themselves do not have cannot afford the fees. Now, a question was asked about the costs involved. We did, I think, the honorable members were there, did provide a very detailed breakdown of what it costs to train a medical student in South Africa, and compared to what it costs to train them in Cuba. And the costs were just under half. The South African, the Cuban students now will be paying almost over 400,000, nearly 500,000, and the number of years in a medical school in South Africa is just over a million, just under a million. And these are calculations we did about 3 years ago or so. So it will certainly have gone up by now. So it is a lot cheaper to train the students in Cuba now or ever before than it is in South Africa. So I just want to reassure the members that the urban legend that it's very costly to take students to Cuba is not actually, it's just an urban legend. I think related to that, Honorable Sekgalo Desai, is the fact that a question was also asked about whether we've made attempts to look for places elsewhere outside South Africa, but not necessarily in Cuba. The truth of the matter is, any place that would be affordable would have to be on the African continent. But unfortunately, all universities in Africa themselves are looking for places, countries are looking for places for their own students. There isn't just enough university capacity on the African continent. We could look for places in Europe and elsewhere. It would be completely unaffordable for the South African government to do that. And that is why we are not even pursuing that option. We haven't even looked at it in detail. We just looked at the costs and what it meant, and it's just not affordable. So yes, we have considered other places outside South Africa. But as you well know, those places are also looking at South Africa. And that's why we have all these students from all over the country under our African Relations Program and the African Solidarity Program, that there are quotas. There's a quota system where African students are allowed places in South African universities, but the reverse cannot happen. It is just not possible. Honourable members, I don't know if there's any other question related to this. The latest initiative that the minister has looked at is establishment of a university. There are plans to build a new medical school in South Africa. Of course, for the next so many years, that will not help our situation now. But there are plans to build this medical school, and maybe in 10 years' time we'll be able to have an uptake of more than what is currently available from the South African medical student, which is pitifully little compared to the need that South Africa. We've got so much need for production, but there's just no capacity in the universities. The only thing that has alleviated the situation for next year is that the universities have agreed to squeeze in an extra 200 medical students. So they've increased their intake for next year by about 20, 30, 40 students per medical school. So it will be slightly better. I mean, it will only be 200 more, and the estimate is that we need about 2,000 a year to cover the need in South Africa, which we all know is our doctors, production of doctors is in a desperate situation, and the need is just, the magnitude is just so incomparable to what the supply that we can give. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I'll hand over to Dr. Anton Pele.
Maybe before Anton comes, I think when we talk about the production, we should balance it with those who are quitting South Africa. I think we need to look how many do leave South Africa after qualifying, after investing. The other thing that was not very clear to me, when you say 400,000, you mean from first year to final year, or is just 1 year and the million? And it would be interesting to know these universities that we have, the eight that we have, which is the most expensive?
The most expensive is UCT and Vets.
Yes. So that 1 million is for the whole course?
Yes.
Even the 400?
Even though, yeah, it's 478, I think, something like that, just under 500.
Have you ever thought of a private medical
school? Unofficially. We have looked, there have been approaches. There is a private medical school that has approached us, but looking at the content and the logistics and whatever, what is it that they stand for, I think it was found unsuitable for many reasons. For many reasons. It was really going against the philosophy of, first it was too much of a business venture, but also it went against the philosophy of equity and bridging the gap to the inequalities. It would just accentuate the inequalities in the country. Let me put it that way. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I deal with four areas I think there were questions on. The first, if I can go in order, I think is on the progress relating to the NHI. We published the green paper, as Dr. Jorgensen had indicated. We received just over 140 comments. Majority of the comments were from interested groupings, stakeholders, either for or against understanding the implications of the NHI for them. We're currently revising the green paper to produce a white paper, and soon I think the minister will be able to release that. We've also embarked on the pilots, as Dr. Pillay had indicated. Now, in the pilots, the 11 districts have produced what we call business plans so that they could then access funding to start the first phases of the pilots. The business plan is the first phase. And all 11 districts have now produced business plans. We had advertised coordinators in every district, in 11 districts, to run the pilots. And we're in the process of appointing most of them across the country. We've also brought on board a team from both the public and private sector to look at contracting in GPs and how that model would work, because across the country, between urban, rural, etc., the contracting arrangements need to take account of the geographic arrangements that GPs are situated in versus the facilities, as well as to make sure that when the private GPs do come into facilities, that all of the equipment is available for them to deliver the service, so they don't come in there and then there's no equipment and then there's delays, and I think that may frustrate them and they may not be interested in continuing to participate. We've also done the facilities assessment so that we understand the readiness of each facility to be NHI ready, if you can call it that. And so where there are challenges with each facility, we plan to deal with that. Dr. Pillay was talking about the facility improvement teams. So that's the progress on the NHI. If I can move to the medicine availability questions, there are a few reasons why there's no medicines available when patients go to facilities. The first is that the facility itself did not order the medicines in time, what's referred to as the standard stock level. I mean, the basic principle, as in any household, when before your sugar or milk or whatever goes to zero, you know you need to go to the shop and get it. And so people in the facility don't employ that principle of saying, well, at this point we now need to order. And people forget, or whatever the reason is, that doesn't happen. Secondly, there is sometimes communication problems between the provincial depots and the facility. So an order may be submitted to the depot doesn't receive it or doesn't receive it in the format in which they can execute the order, and so that doesn't happen. And the facility obviously doesn't follow up with the depot to say, well, I placed an order, why didn't you deliver? The third reason relates to supplier payments. Now, there are cases where provinces have not paid suppliers timelessly. The requirement is that they must be paid in 30 days, and when suppliers don't get paid timelessly, they then obviously withhold additional supplies without formally informing the province that I'm withholding your supplies because you didn't pay me. They just kind of don't execute any more orders until they get that funding. And then I think that there are also challenges, obviously, on the side of suppliers, where they take on contracts that they don't have the capacity to deliver sometimes, or they have problems in their facilities, and they want to keep the business, obviously. So what they do, they never inform the facility. So they receive an order but never say, I'm not going to execute this order because I have problems in my production line. So the facility waits. Remember, the lead time may be anything between 30 to 42 days. So only after 42 days will they tell you, I'm actually not going to be supplying, or you wouldn't get a supply. So that facility or that province would have to go to another supplier and wait another 42 days now in order to get a supply. So in order to deal with these problems, the first thing we've done is we've instituted a monitoring system where we contact provinces every 2 weeks to understand what drugs they don't have and why they don't have it. So is it that they didn't pay the supplier? Is it because the supplier is performing poorly, or is it just that the depot is not supplying to the institution? And the reasons vary, as I pointed out earlier. In terms of supplier payments, every month we get a report from suppliers of which provinces have not paid and outstanding more than 30 days. We submit that to the provincial HODs and appeal to them to please pay these accounts, because failure to pay these accounts has the consequence that they will not be supplied. And then to further to that, we also have a monitoring system at facility level, and we work with civil society as well, where they report to us that we went to a clinic, there was no medicines in this clinic, and then we then act on that. So those are the mechanisms that we have to try and monitor that at a national level. Then if I can move to the MCC, there are several challenges with the MCC, and all of them result largely around delays in registration of medicines. The biggest problem is that there are inadequate number of people to be able to assess these dossiers. The number of dossiers from about 2006 to now has increased threefold, but the staff internally and the evaluators has not increased at all, neither has the budget as a result of this increase in workload. So that is why we're introducing the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority, a body that is able to collect fees, retain those funds, and employ suitably qualified people internally to deal with this. Currently, the applications are assessed by academics who are basically in their university. So they will only assess the applications when they have time to do so. Additionally, I think there are skills gaps between the level of evaluators. So even when we advertise to bring in new evaluators, these people don't have the experience. And the challenge we have is that the current evaluators don't have time or the interest in wanting to train new people in this. So we're going to have to do this on our own. We've advertised for people with basic science degrees, and currently we're engaging with the regulators in both Europe and the US to take these people with basic science degrees and train them to the extent where they can do the evaluations, because internally we're not able to train them. We're going to have to rely on external providers to do that. On the MRC, I think we have appointed Professor Karim as president of MRC to be able to turn around the MRC with the challenges that it has. Now, his report indicates there are a number of challenges in the MRC. The first challenge relates to inefficiency in terms of duplication. So you have two units in the MRC who are effectively doing similar work. Then there's also the MRC, which is supposed to be a research institute, doesn't always produce the research outputs that are required of an institute. So the production of research papers that are of an appropriate quality is very limited in some units. The third area is that some of the areas of research, and I think the chair kind of alluded to that, are unrelated to the burden of disease of South Africa. And so he's put together a turnaround strategy, which we're currently engaging with, that would rationalize the MRC so that it would focus largely on the burden of disease of the country, and the funding will be then linked to that. So units that are doing research for institutions outside of South Africa or unrelated to a burden of disease must then be funded on a separate basis.
than as it's currently being done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I thought you were going to mention something about the institute that has just been completed in Devon, where I think he's in the board too. Karim is in the board, but you can we can talk about that later on.
Thank you, Acting DG. Thank you, honourable members. I'm going to touch on only on two questions. The first one is the CFO already touched on it, but I just want to emphasise that the question that was raised regarding the need of additional budget for Eastern Cape and Limpopo, that honourable members will remember that when the same committee visited the Eastern Cape, the presentation that was made there, province were presenting the projected budget shortfall in terms of the projections, not in terms of the actual project that were on site. Then following that visit by the committee, we did go and evaluate the plans for the province, and then we found that there was no need to get the additional budget for this financial year. That's why the CFO was indicated that we dropped the bid for Eastern Cape to get additional budget for this financial year, because the bid was based on the projection, not based on the project that were on site. And when we look at the possibility to spend, they were going to underspend. That's why we dropped the bid. Then in terms of Limpopo, what happened that is that when Limpopo declared under administration, under Section 100, one of the interventions when we got there to relieve the pressure on the equitable share, we recommended that all projects that were funded under equitable share should be shifted to conditional grants. And that left Limpopo without having budget to start any new project going forward. That's how maybe Limpopo, they talk about new additional funding in terms of addressing new project going forward. But what we do, instead of going to Treasury every time to request for additional budget first, we are revising the whole MTF allocation budget for all provinces to check the readiness to spend the budget. If maybe one of the provinces not ready, then we have to approach the appropriate structures to revise the budget so that we can be able to shift funds from one province to another rather than keep on running to Treasury, whereas we cannot be able to absorb the money that can be allocated over the MTF budget. Then that's one of the, is going to lead to the question regarding the how do we support the province in terms of development of the business plan, because we are changing we are reviewing the priority list and check whether how ready are those projects in terms of implementation. Then the other thing is that most of the provinces, maybe it's because maybe when we started the hospital revitalization program, we were building new facilities, because most of the facilities that we're addressing were on the state that we cannot able to revamp or to upgrade. Then most of the money were trapped on the building of the new new facility. For example, if you look at the size of the Sisile Magwane development hospital, it needs a lot of money, of which in one financial year it needs almost 300 million. And then the province doesn't have that money under the grant. Therefore, they end up channeling the money in new projects rather than making money available for maintenance and upkeep of the existing facility. Then what we are doing as an intervention now is that we are on the process of combining two grants, the hospital infrastructure grant and the hospital revitalization grant into one. And one of the criteria is that we wanted to open it so that provinces can be able to access it without having some other tough issues that can be maybe not allow, give chance to province to access the money. Then we are saying that the province is supposed to put a certain percentage of money, certain portion of money for maintenance, a certain percentage for upgrade and upkeep, and a certain percentage for new. Then we are guiding them so that they can able to address all the various and that's the process that we are just waiting for approval. And if it's going to be approved, then we're going to start in the coming financial year. And we do that exercise based on the current available data that we gathered from the province. The next question is regarding the essential equipment list, that the question that was raised What are those basic equipment that the PM Minister was referring to in terms of in our facilities? We, in the previous financial year, we developed the essential equipment list for primary health care facilities and also for hospitals. And then this is one of the lists that we use when we do the health facility audit. And then currently the department is deploying most of the senior managers under the program called facility improvement teams. And then those are the one of the lists that we are using when we go out to check whether those facilities, they are using the basic equipment that are required for the service that are rendered in our facilities. Thanks.
Maybe thanks very much. Is it Mpafudi? Mpafudi, not Mpafudi. Okay, it's almost 5 to 1. I was thinking that since we are still coming back, it was going to be the last one. Oh, maybe, well, let's allow the last one and then we'll come back at 2 o'clock. Don't be worried about the members that are leaving. They're coming back at 2 o'clock. Don't think that you're safe. They're not going to ask you more because they're still coming back. They're coming back at 2, even those who have left. Okay.
Mine were very brief. The first one was about the number of provinces that received written feedback from the National Department of Health on their annual performance plans last year. And the annual report indicates that 7 out of 9 provinces received written feedback, with the exclusion of Gauteng and the Western Cape. So the explanation is that in terms of verbal feedback given through meetings and other engagements, all 9 provinces did receive feedback. But when the unit responsible for planning prepares the written feedback at the end of August and at the end of November, priority is given to those provinces that are struggling in terms of capacity to develop plans. So Western Cape and Gauteng are very strong. If you look at the quality of the plans that they produce, those two provinces are quite strong. And therefore, when it comes to feedback and support, we tend to prioritize the not-so-strong provinces. I don't call them the weaker provinces, the ones that are not so strong. So that is why then the priority was allocated to those 7 provinces. The second one relates to the annual national health plan. That's why it was not printed and published. The annual national health plan, which is a plan that integrates the NDOH plan and the plans of the 9 provinces, was produced and tabled before the technical committee, which is the HODs and the DG, but not before the NHC, which is the minister and the MHCs. The reason was that it was overtaken by subsequent developments. What became a priority was the development of the negotiated service delivery agreement. The processes were running in parallel. But if you look at the value and the importance and the significance, the completion of the NSDA 2010-2014 with the correct figures provided by the Health Data Advisory Committee, which Dr. Pillay reflected there, became of more paramount importance so that that plan becomes a macro plan guiding the entire health sector in terms of priority setting and implementation. Thank you.
Ms. Ladler would like to add the chair.
Thank you very much. I think it's more because Dr. Jürgen Pillay has set out actually comment, and I thought it would be appropriate to comment after Mr. Masilela, because under the Chief Operating Office, we actually have planning, we have monitoring and evaluation, research, and also information. And the third cluster is one for provincial support, which is what Dr. Jürgen Pillay referred to. Currently, the team in that cluster is actually quite limited number of people available. They are supporting the administrator in terms of financial support. And we are also looking at assessment of service delivery. In that, we are actually looking at all the interventions that have been highlighted in this presentation and saying, at an operational level, why are we failing to deliver? Why are we not seeing improvement? So currently we are actually visiting all hospitals in Limpopo. We visited, I joined the department on the 17th of August and was actually out in the field within 2 weeks and we visited 26 of the 40 facilities, and we hope by first week of November to have actually completed all hospitals, and we will actually have a report at that point. So it's really penetrating at a lower level and bringing all the interventions within the department and saying, we are doing all of this work. Why are we not actually seeing movement in those areas? So our level with that, those teams, there will be three directorates, and in each directorate, there will be focus on three provinces. So there will be three directorates focusing on, you know, different provinces, and we hope we can feedback as we move in terms of that cluster, as we get more people and our work becomes more focused. Currently, we are working in Mpopo with the administrator on service delivery. Thank you.
So you'll never forget your date of employment, because it happened after Marikana, the day after Marikana. So you'll never forget it. Members, I think let's just leave it at that, and then we come back at 2 o'clock, and we left. So we accept your maiden speech. That was your maiden speech. Okay. We'll come back at 2 o'clock exactly and then continue. I don't know, maybe you can decide who to invite from this side, because they don't have money there. Okay. When we come back, there'll be a few questions to answer, then you can round up.
You still have a program.